Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear discussions which followed screenings of two 2014 documentary films, Alive Inside, directed by Michael Rosato Bennett, and Citizen Four, directed by Laura Poitras. This program, the first half presented in collaboration with the Douglas County Health Center Foundation, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 24, 2015, and Friday evening, December 12, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The members of the first panel will be Sabra Mackey, Activities, Therapeutic Recreation, and Volunteer Coordinator at the Douglas County Health Center, and Linda Whitfield, Program Director for the Douglas County Health Center. The moderator will be Amy Chittenden, President of the Douglas County Health Center Foundation. The special guest in the second half will be G. Michael Fenner, James L. Coley Professor of Constitutional Law at the Creighton University School of Law, immediate past president of the Nebraska Bar Association, and author of the article, Edward Snowden, Hero or Traitor? An uplifting cinematic exploration of music in the mind, Alive Inside won the Audience Award at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. This stirring documentary follows social worker Dan Cohen, founder of the nonprofit organization Music and Memory, as he fights against a broken healthcare system to demonstrate music's ability to combat memory loss and restore a deep sense of self to those suffering from it. Director Michael Rosato Bennett visits family members who have witnessed the miraculous effects of personalized music on their loved ones and offers illuminating interviews with experts including renowned neurologist Oliver Sacks and musician Bobby McFerrin. Here now to introduce the panel is our moderator, Amy Chittenden.
Let me introduce Linda Whitfield. And she is a retired certified nursing associate from the health center. She volunteers at the health center. She has a daughter who is a nurse at the health center. And she has a brother-in-law who lives at the health center, and he is a user of the Music and Memory program at the health center. So I'm really interested to hear what she has to bring to the conversation about that. And on my far right is Sabra Mackey. She is our activities therapeutic rec and volunteer coordinator at the health center. And so she has been the foundation's main partner with the Music and Memory program. So we, Douglas County Health Center, we are one of three long-term care facilities in Omaha that uses this program. And when I went to kind of do some research on that, it seems shocking to me that after seeing a film like this and seeing the positivity it can bring, that everyone is not doing this. And so I wanted to look up statewide kind of what the statistics were as well. And there are 219 long-term care facilities in Nebraska. Only 10 are using Music and Memory. I'll leave it there for now. So Sabra and Linda, first time seeing the film, yes? And talking to the mic.
Yes, this is my first time seeing the film, and I really enjoyed it, and it brought back memory. You know, my brother-in-law, he enjoys the music, and when he has it on, he wants to listen, and he did. Just like the resident that was on the film, it brought back memory, and he get to saying, you know, if only, you know, he could have had a different aspect of life, and you know, and it just made him feel good. And then I'm with some of the residents that I see that uses the music. If they in a bad mood and you give them that, it put them in a whole different atmosphere where they be cooperative, and it just does them good. And yeah. I really enjoy it. My brother-in-law really likes it.
And Sabra, is this your first time seeing the film?
Yes, it is.
And what did you think? I mean, you work with this program. Did that resonate with you? Are we seeing those types of results with residents at the health center?
Yes, we have a guy that's just like Henry that taps his feet and sings. Yes. We have people that like her brother-in-law that, you know, he doesn't communicate that well, but when he has it on his head, he smiles from ear to ear and nods and just, you know, closes his eyes and just, you can tell he's just really into the music. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we see all that and more. Yeah.
And I should give you some parameters about the health center. We are a long-term care facility. We have 254 beds. We are not always at full capacity. And we typically, we skew a little bit different than your average nursing home or long-term care facility. Most of our population is male. A good percentage of our population is 65 and under. And the primary diagnosis of the health center residents is dementia. And then the second most common primary diagnosis is mental health issues. So that kind of gives you a glimpse of what our residents are living with, what their situation is like. We are a heavily Medicaid-funded facility. Many of the residents don't have family members that are available to visit. Many of them lack those support systems. So that kind of gives you an idea of our resident population. How long has your brother lived at the health center?
3 years.
3 years.
And he said, you know, he really likes it there. And, I can communicate with him. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, that Douglas County is the best place he's ever been in. He's been in 3 facilities. And he really likes it there.
And did I pay you to say that? No. I did not pay you to say that. No.
No.
No. Yeah, we were talking before the film, and you were kind of discussing about that. He's been through a few facilities in our community,
mm-hmm.
and coming to Douglas County, did you have anything to do with that? Like, did you bring him to the facility because
yes.
you were there?
Well, yes, I brought him there because I seen, you know, it was the best facility. I always liked Douglas County. That's why I retired and went back and volunteered, because mm-hmm. Douglas County is really a wonderful place. And I was telling her, I told my daughter, now I'm telling you now, while I'm in my right mind, if I need a facility, take me to Douglas County.
Which is great. That's
yes.
great. Saber, I want to ask you, they talked a lot about in the film that one thing they kind of tout is that the music needs to be pretty personalized. And so how do you, I know when we started on the program, you had some students come in from Clarkson and do the resident assessments, but what do you do when the resident cannot communicate with you? I mean,
well,
how did you get around those?
The next best
barriers?
Thing is to ask their family or friends mm-hmm. what they might like. And even sometimes then we don't have anybody we can ask.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what I would do is pick something from the era of when maybe they were a teenager or a young adult and try that and see how that works with them.
And has that, a thought I had when I was thinking about this film earlier was, do you find that there are some pretty, there are kind of a universality to certain songs, like, I don't know, hymns or folk songs, or I don't know, everyone loves the Beatles or everyone loves Elvis. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
There's no.
Yeah, but there's some, you know, sometimes we've tried iPods that belong to somebody else and maybe this other person doesn't have one yet. And mm-hmm. so they may try so-and-so's on this other person just
mm-hmm.
and they really like that music, and so we may put some of that on for that person.
That's a really good idea, actually. We have, you said, over 100 residents on the program.
Yes, we are very lucky to have such a nice foundation at Douglas County, and we have about 120 iPods right now, and I think just about everybody who wants one has one.
How long has your brother been in the program?
He's probably had one about a year.
Okay, mm-hmm. okay. That brings up a point where I wanted to jump to. The film, you can see at a part in the film where Dan Cohen kind of goes to some nursing home administrators, and there's pushback, a little bit of pushback. I mean, and you have to understand the circumstances that, you know, these folks are working with. 600 residents. My gosh, that is a huge facility. I mean, I was shocked when I heard that. And I think they talk a lot about cost being a barrier. So I wanted to kind of pull together. We have been involved with Music and Memory for 2.5 years. October 2012 is when we first got certified on the program. And the foundation to date has spent $4,000, which doesn't seem like, well, to improve the quality of life of residents, I guess I don't feel like that's bad value. So I wanted to be sure that that was out there publicly, because you can see from the film just how important it is, yes, to people and their lives. I mean, you, yes, laughed a lot, you know, mm-hmm, and I think we all laughed a lot when we see some of those resident behaviors or just kind of that resident life, and we all know what that's about. And I think that, you know, you laughed when
it stirs them up, you, yes, know, bring when that they start memory, yes,
yeah, when they start singing, mm-hmm, and when they kind of come out of themselves. And it's not a panacea. It doesn't work 100% all the time with all the people. But I thought you made a really good point about how when people are in distress or when people are upset, mm-hmm, you certainly have witnessed,
yes,
that experience. Mm-hmm. And
it just calms them down, and you know, it just put them in another atmosphere,
mm-hmm,
where they'd be co-op. You know, they just do anything and just so lovable.
Right. And it's not medication. It's, mm-mm, not something where, you know, we're kind of taking this kind of medical approach. It's more of a, well, holistic approach, I guess I would say. I thought when the couple was sitting across from each other, she was cognizant, he was listening to the earphones, and they were singing that song, "You're Just So Good to Be True, Can't Keep My Eyes Off of You." And you clearly see, in many of these faces, you clearly see family pain. And I thought that that was so interesting when, you know, he said to her, "This is a hard life for you." And I wondered if your experience, Linda, was if you have seen a change in your brother-in-law since he, yes, came on the program.
Yes.
And do you find it's a way to kind of bring that, you know, go through that back door that Oliver Sacks, I think, talked about?
Yes, I see a big change. Even my husband said, you know, it made a difference, you know, the way he, you know, his attitude, you know, he's in a good spirit when he's listening to that,
mm-hmm,
to music.
You did say, though, he stays in his room to listen, mm-hmm, to his music.
Yes. You got to come on out now.
Yes. Yeah. So it's
he's
good.
He's attached to the music instead. You know, you want to roam around with him.
Right. Now, Sabra, I noticed when Henry, you know, when you were seeing him throughout the film, you kind of see him come alive, and he's moving a lot. And, you know, you work with rec therapy, you work with those who kind of need that kind of physical attention. Do you think even if they're just listening to the music and just kind of that physicality helps them, is that beneficial? Does it do positive things for their health outcomes?
Right. Or? I think that if you ask somebody to move, they're not really motivated to move, but, mm-hmm, you put the music on them and they're going to do it on their own. You don't even have to ask them. So, mm-hmm, yeah, it helps with range of motion and just all that good stuff. It's just very therapeutic as far as the physical goes. Mm-hmm. I've seen people get up and try to dance too that shouldn't be getting up.
Yes.
And I think anyone who has spent any time in a long-term care facility has definitely seen the "it's stuck" door. I don't know if you guys caught that. That was pretty great. I was also just mesmerized about how their faces just change. I mean, just this, mm-hmm, peace comes, mm-hmm, over them. Particularly Gil. I loved that he was just super feisty, and I loved that, you know, he kind of took on this music, and just your attention is drawn towards Denise because she's the one speaking to the film. But if you looked at Gil, he's just sitting there and he's just enjoying it so much. I think that that was really impressive. And I'm just wondering if that, again, is it typical? Is it outside the norm? Is that what we should expect? I would encourage everyone here, you can go to the Music of Memory website and they will give you a guide. You can download a guide on how to create a playlist with your family member. You don't need to join Music of Memory just to make this happen with your loved one. So keep that in mind. But yeah, I mean, typical, outside the norm.
I'd say it's pretty typical to see just the facial expressions change when they're listening to music that they like. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe have somebody, we have one individual with Alzheimer's that will sit there and just laugh and sing and start clapping and kind of dance around even though he's hunched over.
Yeah.
And just, you know, otherwise he may just be sitting there with his head down. So
yes. And your comment reminded me of where I was trying to go. I was trying to fake it and act like I knew where I was going, but I didn't. So now I do. The film talks a lot about Alzheimer's dementia. We see someone with multiple sclerosis. But we use the program on many different residents who have many different health issues. It's not simply for Alzheimer's and dementia. And Linda's brother, and you don't have to disclose why he is in the health center, but he is not an Alzheimer's and dementia resident, but he clearly gets a lot out of the program.
Yes.
So I think that that's really important to kind of have your voice on the panel to talk about that. So I really appreciate you coming out
You're
and talking
welcome.
About that. We have questions?
So it's really powerful film, and when you think about it for babies, when they respond to sound and to music, and lots of studies about how that encourages brain development and learning and all that stuff. So I thought I heard you say you had 120 iPods.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there's not enough iPads for all the residents at the facility. So if people wanted to fund this, do it as a service project.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's
thinking,
a good one.
You know, there's lots of different groups that want to do something. Who would they contact and how would they help make that happen?
They can call me.
Ooh, look at that. She took it right away from me.
Yeah, so we take iPod donations. You know, the kids always get new things for Christmas. So, you know, it's a great way to give a tax-deductible donation. Or you can donate money to the foundation. And then when we need to buy things, we just call Jerry, and he gives us a check.
One thing to your point about services projects, I read an article about Music and Memory and about how a long-term care facility in Healdsburg, California, used it as a seventh grade project for their students because the students at that time are learning about bodies and life science. And so it was a really nice crossover to get these kids into a facility. And I think they said it was two students to one resident, and it really turned out quite well. So, to your question.
I had a question about when you're using the music therapy, does that alter the medications that someone might be taking?
That's a great question.
I think that they could probably use the iPod, you know, if somebody's being agitated, to use the iPod before trying to give a medication as an intervention before, you know, that would have to be given.
So the medications that they're on before music therapy continues even through the process.
Some people are on what they call an as-needed medication. So if they're real agitated and they can't redirect them in another way, eventually they can give a medication for that. But this could be a step that they could try with somebody before they gave the medication so they wouldn't have to give it.
I did read that one long-term care facility, and this was early days, so I'm not sure how well the kind of study or research would hold up, but one long-term care facility was talking about that their usage of antipsychotics had dropped dramatically after a couple years on the program. But, you know, I don't think that's been replicated in any sort of wide-ranging study. There is a group in Wisconsin kind of working on that right now with all long-term care facilities in Wisconsin. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, it would be great. It would be great.
I have a comment and a question. Okay. I think it was really very well done in the film, talking about how we see aging in our society. And my husband's at the Eastern Nebraska Veterans Home, and they have 10 people trained to do this program, and they've been working on it. But they could use more iPods as well. And I'll be working on that with my Altrusa group. I think that we really need, as an individual and as families, think about how we see the elderly. Mm-hmm. And I'm one. So that's my concern, too, in terms of what you bring to the table.
Yes.
And I think in other cultures, we have a greater appreciation of the elderly and what we bring to the table. Mm-hmm. I have a 21-month-old living with me now since she was 4 months old. And the bond that we have created is based on music. And I didn't realize it till I saw this tonight.
Oh, that's great.
And it's a wonderful thing. And I'm grateful that I am appreciated in my family for what I bring to the table, but not always.
Well, it's definitely interesting that they do talk about, I thought the woman, her name was Bonnie, and she had that fascinating comment about, you know, I don't want it. We put it over there. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know about it. And you just think, oh, my goodness, I mean, we are all gonna age. I mean, that's just life. So you're kind of denying yourself, I'd say. But you want to talk, clearly.
What she said, what you bring to the table, it came to my mind, what you bring to the table, you have to have the love for people and love in your heart to work with the elderly.
So true. And that Yvonne at the in the facility that we saw, that was just so lovely. There are hundreds of them at the health center, so I have to tout that, because there we have such wonderful people. So yay you guys. Okay, Brooke has another question.
This may be answered by the website, but are there typical periods in a person's life that you focus on when developing the playlist? So is it a mostly high school and college years of that person? Is that when music is maybe most influential to them? And then the second question is there a typical number of songs that would be on a person's playlist, or does that depend on where they are in the stage of the disease?
I'm going to, the second half of that, I think Sabre could, you know, the song, number of songs. Like, do you find that there's a maxing out point kind of with them? Yeah,
I think it would depend on how wide their genre is that they like. I mean, if they like a lot of genres, then you could put a lot on there. Ours are 2 gigs, so they hold about, I don't know, 260 songs. But some people don't want that much.
And I would say to the first half of your question, Music and Memory, again, does have, if you go to their website, they have guides that can kind of give you those probing questions. And I will confess, I have not looked at the guides, looked at a lot on the website, but not those particularly. But my suspicion would be that it's kind of in that time. Well, maybe you can answer this too, because you went through the training.
Yeah, it could.
Sorry.
A lot of people relate to music from when they're teenagers and young adults, but not always. For example, I have a lady in her 60s that likes hardcore rap music.
Wow.
And you wouldn't expect that.
Wow. I love it.
So I'm just saying, you just can't assume.
How did you figure that out?
She told me.
Oh, okay. Great.
So you can't just assume what people would like. The best way is to ask them. And like if I said earlier, they can't answer. You want to ask their family or friends or...
Yeah. And I would suspect it's kind of when your mind is, you know, when your mind is most plastic. Well, maybe that's when you're a baby. I don't know. But, you know, teenage years is kind of that same idea. Brooke has another question.
I have some questions. Hello.
Hi.
First and foremost, this was fabulous. I love it, and thank you guys for doing this and allowing us to ask questions. So I have one question first on how you administer it. So for all of the folks there at your facility, how are you doing this? Is it a daily thing, weekly thing? How does it work? And are you using it in those times of distress before going to their as-needed meds? And then my second question before I forget, is just how in the world do we share this with others? I need other people to see this film as well, and I know this is a two-night thing, so how can we share this?
One night. I would say what I did, I'm going to let Saber answer the program questions. What I did was so easy, went to iTunes, and I rented it for 24 hours for $2.99. I watched it three times in preparation for tonight because I didn't want to cry here. So I did that at home. But you can also go to their website is musicandmemory.org. And they will work with you on setting up a screening. They will work with you on bringing a speaker in if you want. And one of the reasons we brought it in was because I really, really wanted to partner with FilmStreams. And no one close to us was playing this film. And I just think it has such a powerful message. And I think it's so universal that it needed to be seen. So your other question was daily, weekly, monthly,
okay,
hourly?
So how we started post-med? Was with, because we only had about 20 iPods to start with. So who am I talking to? Right there. So we started with the people that we thought needed it most. And so we made sure those people got their iPods first. And pretty much now we try to get them for them when they're admitted to our facility. And then as far as daily using, on our rehab neighborhood, a lot of the residents there are cognitively intact and they can figure out how to use it and plug it in to charge it. So we have them, we just give it to them and let them borrow it while they're at our facility. And then in the long-term care neighborhoods, the nursing staff administers it, or the rec staff or a family member can ask for it. We keep them at the nurse's station and they keep them charged for us and ready to go.
I'm really interested in the neurological part, like they showed the brain and what part of the brain retains that and responds to that. How do we find out more about that? Like personally, like we were visiting my husband's uncle and it had been a while since we'd seen him, and he didn't really seem to know who we were. We said something about Parkersburg, West Virginia, and he launched into the Parkersburg fight song.
Oh, how funny.
And he did the whole thing, and like, what? And then when his daughter got there, he did it again. She'd never heard it in her life.
Oh, wow.
But it stays, things like that stay in there.
Yes.
And that's like, you know, teenage years and so on. So
yes.
Is there a lot of really specific neurological research like that to say?
I'm going to guess that there is, but I don't know that research. But there has to be, and I would think that a good way to kind of search for that is to, you know, go to Music and Memory. They have a lot of great information. I know I keep saying that. And I don't mean it to sound like a cop-out, but I think Oliver Sacks spoke to it fairly well in a fairly easily understood way about how, you know, it's the movement and it's the listening and the movement, and it kind of somehow embeds itself in our, you know, deepest self. I don't know. I don't know. There has to be research out there. That I'm sure would be fairly easy to find if you just kind of Google brain research music. how about that? And you'll get 100 million responses. And you got to figure it out.
Does it have to be with headphones, and does it have to be so individualized? I mean, couldn't I just take my ukulele into a long-term care facility and play a bunch of oldies and make everybody happy?
I think we do that too. I think we do. I think a lot of one thing that I'm not sure he says it in the film, but Dan Cohen certainly says it in other blurbs or interviews that he's given, that, you know, he knows that music therapy is one of the most utilized programs in a long-term care facility. So when I say music therapy, I mean just like what you're saying. Someone goes in, they perform, they connect, and we saw it with the gentleman from Uganda. So, yes, you can. Adopt a home. Find one. Do it.
I just wanted to find out, do you bring groups of young people in to share in this experience at all? I'm thinking of when you're talking about sharing things on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That's all our kids do.
Mm-hmm.
They share these experiences with one another and with the world, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So just being able to do even a showing like this for young people, getting them involved out of school, mm-hmm. At their after-school communities, things like that.
Yeah.
They're the iPod users.
True.
And to put them together with our elderly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen changes in young kids and how excited they get.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that, you know, if we can get it out to more youth and get them excited about it, because they're going to be where we are soon and we're going to be where they are soon.
Yeah, I hate to admit this, but I have used some of our teenage volunteers to show us how to do iTunes a little better. I'll admit that. So, yes, they have been really helpful to us because, for example, I didn't know how to convert a song to MP3 format. So one of my volunteers showed me how to do that. But, awesome. We do have a lot of teen volunteers. I would always like to have more. So if you know any good teen volunteers, you can call me.
That's awesome. And I'm going to go and have my mom and my dad make their playlist now. I mean,
yes,
find
do
out
that.
What they like.
Set
now.
Up a playlist. Yeah. Set up a playlist. Well, I really want to thank everyone for coming out and supporting the film and supporting Film Streams. And I really want to thank my superstar panelists who have been holding my hand through this process for about a week. So I really appreciate it. I value your time. So thanks.
Thank you.
On the second half of today's program, we'll hear a question and answer session which followed a showing of the 2014 documentary film Citizen 4, directed by Laura Poitras. The special guest is G. Michael Fenner, James L. Coley Professor of Constitutional Law at the Creighton University School of Law, immediate past president of the Nebraska Bar Association, and author of the article Edward Snowden, Hero or Traitor. Citizen 4, which won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film in 2015, is a real-life thriller unfolding by the minute, giving audiences unprecedented access to filmmaker Laura Poitras and journalist Glenn Greenwald's encounters with Edward Snowden in Hong Kong as he hands over classified documents providing evidence of mass indiscriminate and illegal invasions of privacy by the National Security Agency and the Obama administration. Poitras had already been working on a film about surveillance for 2 years when Snowden contacted her using the name Citizen 4 in January 2013. He reached out to her because he knew she had long been a target of Obama administration surveillance, stopped at airports numerous times, and had refused to be intimidated. When Snowden revealed he was a high-level analyst driven to expose the massive surveillance of Americans by the NSA, Poitras persuaded him to let her film. Citizen 4 places you in the room with Poitras, Greenwald, and Snowden as they attempt to manage the media storm raging outside, forced to make quick decisions that will impact their lives and all of those around them. Edward Snowden has been compared to Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times in the early 1970s, outlining United States political and military involvement in Vietnam from 1945 to 1967. Here now to discuss Citizen 4 is Creighton Law Professor G. Michael Fenner.
I want to make one comment. I want to ask and answer one question before we turn it over to you. I'll start with the first question, and that is, are you being surveilled? Last December, General Keith Alexander, and at the time he led the NSA and the U.S. Cyber Command, he said the NSA is collecting metadata of more than 300 million Americans. Last December, the population of the United States was just over 317 million. So 300 million is most of us. The Wall Street Journal reported that the NSA gets only 20% of our phone records. The article reports that they get 20% of the phone records of 95% of us, and their stated intention is to catch up. So the answer to the question, are you being surveilled, is probably yes. And I think probably since I published this article that many of you were given as you walked in, the answer to the question, am I being surveilled, is probably definitely. So those of you who we sometimes hang out together, you might want to start being more careful. Shall we just start with the questions?
Do you think that this film is an accurate or reasonable portrayal of the constitutional issues that are implicated by the Snowden disclosures?
Well, Eric, I don't think it's really a no. I don't think it's really much of a portrayal of the constitutional issues. There are search and seizure issues to be discussed. There are privacy issues to be discussed, although under this court, there's not much to that right anymore. There are some serious free speech issues to be discussed. And that involves whether this kind of surveillance chills people's right to speak, makes people afraid to speak. Back in the 60s, during the civil rights era, the FBI used to send agents out with cameras with no film in them. And they'd go to the rallies, and they'd just pretend to be taking pictures. And what they were trying to accomplish was to frighten people away from the meetings, to frighten people away from associating, to frighten people away from speaking. So there's a serious free speech issue involved here. And the biggest issue to me is, you know, when we talk about individual liberties and the protections of the Constitution, we talk about the Bill of Rights, search and seizure and freedom of speech and free exercise of religion. But one of the greatest innovations, I think, that the framers of the Constitution made when they wrote that document was separation of powers. And one of the great protectors of our individual liberties is separation of powers. They divided the power. And they divided it, of course, among the three branches of the federal government. The problem is that separation of powers can't work if one branch hides what it's doing from the other two. In 1978, I think it was, Congress, there were a lot of revelations. There were a bunch of people who broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and they stole a bunch of documents. It's the less modern equivalent of what Eric Snowden did. They stole a bunch of documents, and they sent them out to various reporters. Well, these documents showed that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had been engaging in a lot of illegal surveillance, also showed that the CIA had been involved in a lot of illegal surveillance, and so Congress stepped in and they passed the Federal Intelligence Security Act, and they tried to make sure that the power would be divided. And they said that before the FBI can get any national security engage in this kind of surveillance, they have to go to this special court that the Act set up and get a warrant. And it also created the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to oversee executive branch surveillance. Well, the without going into the details, the executive branch has just continued to engage in this kind of surveillance. And there's pretty solid information that they're not really going to the special court to get warrants. And there's pretty solid solid evidence that they're not reporting the truth to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In fact, it was not long ago revealed that the CIA was tapping the emails of the members of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So when you ask yourself who guards the guardians, well, it's the Senate Select Committee, and yet the guardians, the CIA, they're spying on the very committee that's supposed to be providing them oversight. I think that, so here's the short answer is no.
This should be a good follow-up to that question.
Okay.
In the beginning of the film, there is a legal proceeding that's ongoing. Do you know or can speculate how many legal proceedings as a result of this action by Snowden are now underway? Is it dozens? Is it hundreds? Thousands?
I don't know. I don't know. I can't narrow that down for you, but this is interesting. Today, I got a phone call from a lawyer in Montana who had read the article that I published in the magazine, and he wanted to talk to me about suing the NSA. So there are all kinds of these little lawsuits that keep popping up. They, for a lot of reasons, they tend not to get very far. For technical reasons, they tend not to get very far, and for reasons that the judges just kind of don't want to get involved in this. But this special court that has been set up has to review these surveillance warrants. Judges on that court have written opinions that say that the NSA is not abiding by these warrants, and that when the court refuses to give a warrant, the NSA goes ahead and does the surveillance anyway. There are a lot of cases coming out of that particular court that was set up by the Intelligence Act that the NSA isn't complying with the law anyway. So the executive branch has these legal opinions that say that they don't have to follow the law, and that means they don't have to abide by the statute, and that means that even if a court orders them to do or not to do something, they don't have to abide by that either.
I just had a quick question. I know you're a constitutional scholar, but I was wondering if you could bear with me and possibly comment on the ramifications this has on international law and America's dealings with other countries and perhaps the American perception abroad.
Well, first of all, I thank you for it'll be now preserved in perpetuity on KIOS that I'm a scholar. I think the international implications are really just mostly political implications. I think that when Chancellor Merkel got all upset about her phone calls being intercepted, I think that was a political move on her part. I can't imagine that she was surprised that we were surveilling her, and I can't imagine that she's not surveilling us. So I think she's just making a scene for the folks back home. I think that mostly the ramifications are just political. For example, why is Russia allowing Edward Snowden to stay there? Well, that's just Vladimir Putin. I guess it's radio, so I can do that. It's just Vladimir Putin doing that to us.
I've read that We the People petition was initiated and acquired the 100,000 requisite signatures within 2 weeks. The president is supposed to respond to that petition in a timely manner and has not done so. And that happened, I think, in 2013. What is our recourse after that?
Well, good luck getting the president to respond to anything like that. We have to get incensed. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. At some point, a German director, film director, Linda invited him to a sort of a pre-final cut showing of this movie, and his complaint was that this is not going to lead to any change because the story is too big. And when I read that, I was reminded of what Stalin said. He said, "One death is a tragedy. 1 million is a statistic." And here we have an agency that is collecting 5 billion new records a day, metadata regarding our phone records and our emails and what where we go on the web and all of that sort of stuff. The story's too big. It's not personal enough. Michael Brown is personal. Eric Garner is personal. And so right or wrong, those are the stories that get the attention. And, you know, you think back on, if you think back on the Holocaust, it's so difficult to tell that story in a way that's gripping for the very reason that Joseph Stalin said, one death is a tragedy, 1 million deaths is a statistic. And it takes something like Steven Spielberg in Schindler's List, with the film that it was in black and white except for one thing, the red coat that little girl wore when she was going off to the camp, going off to be gassed. That has an emotional impact because it's about, or Sophie's Choice, where Sophie has to make the decision which of her children will live and which will be shot by the Nazis. And if she doesn't make the decision, they'll shoot them both. It's too big a story. That's part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is this won't happen to me. I don't have anything to hide. If they're surveilling me, well, maybe that's the price we have to pay for liberty. Maybe we have to give up some liberty to have liberty. So that problem always reminds me, and I wrote this down so that I could quote it. That story, that problem, the one, it won't happen to me, reminds me of this poem by Pastor Martin Niemöller, who was a Lutheran pastor in Germany at the time the Nazis had taken over. In Germany, they first came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then they came for me, and by that time no one was left to speak up. So if you want to try to corral this or control it, you just have to get mad enough. Since we're in a movie theater, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. You have to get enough people who are mad enough, and I don't know that that's going to happen.
I also consider you to be a constitutional scholar.
Oh, thanks.
And so
can just get a third person to say that. Okay.
I think there's a show of hands. Given that, I would really like to learn your considered professional opinion. Given the national security deficits that are implicated by the revealing of information of this sort, do you think at bottom that these information acquisition programs are unconstitutional under the federal constitution?
My problem in today's world is that I'm not very good at black and white thinking, and I'm much better at seeing sides. I see a couple of my students here. They might be able to confirm that. I think that this is a serious separation of powers problem. I'd like to be able to say it's a serious unreasonable seizure problem under the Fourth Amendment, because that's easier to talk about, or that it's. But I think it really is a serious separation of powers problem. When the president says he can ignore judicial orders and he can ignore statutes and he can ignore them in the name of national security, but It's not that the president says, I'm ignoring these things because we need to surveil these terrorists. The president is saying, I can ignore these things so that we can surveil everybody to find out who might be a terrorist or be in contact with a terrorist. There's no reasonable suspicion for most of this surveillance. And so I find it troubling that the president, you know, the war on terror. Well, the war on drugs has taken more lives than the war on terror. Why? What president wouldn't like to have all this power to fight the war on drugs? I'm getting a little too worked up here and starting to digress. I think it's a serious separation of powers problem, and also a serious free speech problem.
The whole idea of we need to get incensed and we need to get outraged. I'm straining to see why we would, because we give up our freedom of our privacy frequently whenever we click the accept on the thing, and then when we Google search something, we get these cool advertisements. And so I can see that we can say we're inconvenienced. We can say, look, you guys stole my privacy. What am I getting for it? Let's see, bang for the buck. How many people are you actually trapping in this way when you throw out this great net and look at everybody with this scrutiny and make me live in this glass house that you do? But even then, I'm thinking culturally, we're changing as a people. I guess it's, I know all questions should have a question mark. And I guess what I'm asking for you here to do is, do you see potential, any angle to get people outraged or incensed to say something? I'm saying that we aren't getting our money's worth here for our vote, for them, the people we have in power, to look at everybody and get so little for it.
Always in times of war, the president has taken extraordinary powers. And part of what you just talked about, times have changed. And maybe that was in some sense okay at a time when war was against a defined group of people who all wore uniforms different from ours, and when war was going to be over in 2, 3, 4 years, and then we could go back to being who we were. The problem here is the war on terror is likely to go on, well, if not forever, at least for the lifetime of everybody in this room. And so it's not that we're just sort of temporarily giving up some freedom, some liberty. It's that we're giving it up for the rest of our lives. And there are two sides of this story. We need guardians. We learned when we were living in caves, we learned that we're vulnerable when we sleep, and somebody needs to stay alert. Somebody needs to be guarding us. The question is, who's going to guard the guardians? And I think the Constitution says that the guardians here are all three branches, and they guard each other, and that's not happening. So if you want to get people incensed, how do you go about doing it? I don't know.
What should we be doing to stymie this, stop it, prevent it? I mean, where do we go from here now that we know that this is going on?
That's a really difficult question. I think that not enough people are concerned about this. When you talk about this, more people have in mind their vision of the planes flying into the Twin Towers and their vision of people with bombs in their underwear trying to get on planes. I think an awful lot of people are willing to give up an immense amount of privacy to feel safe. And I don't know how you change that. I'm not in the business of trying to change it. I'm more in the business of studying it. So I don't have an answer. Political action, but that's difficult. You know, it was easy in the 60s. Political action was easy because the treatment of African Americans was right there, and it was on TV, and the dogs were on TV, and the beatings were on TV. And it was easy to get people incensed about that. The war in Vietnam, it was easy to get people incensed about that because people of power, people with money, people with prestige and position, their children were being drafted and sent over. You don't feel the effects of this surveillance in the same way that you felt the effects of segregation and of the war in Vietnam.
I guess the first question is, I think the Eric Garner case is kind of the thin edge of the wedge, though, because what it is at the surveillance that really, who cares what the government watches you? Obviously, the FBI isn't taking your picture and then, like, putting it on a wall to, like, admire your complexion or something. They're doing it to put you on a list for future retaliation. And so, you know, the police having impunity and killing people on camera, right in plain view and not getting prosecuted, that's the next step, obviously. It's not like, you know, Nicaraguans are genetically inferior in that they have death squads there because they're bad people. It's because people can be put in the situation where they will kill you
And well, if I understand what you're saying, if I understand what you've said so far, it sounded to me like you're saying that the police are killing people with impunity even when they're on camera, and I would dispute that. I don't believe that's true. But go ahead.
I saw the picture. Didn't you see the video?
Okay, so one guy gets killed, and it's not really clear. And I wouldn't. I think it goes way too far to say that the police killed that man with impunity. I think you have to accept that there's possibly another side to that. You have to understand that this officer did not necessarily intend to kill that man. He intended to put him in a hold that went awry. And were there better ways he could have controlled the situation? Surely. But killing with impunity has an element of intent to it that I don't think you can find.
I killed somebody in a fist fight, in a bar fight, I would be charged with manslaughter, some sort of crime.
But that's a whole different thing than the police trying to make a lawful arrest and perhaps making a mistake. Perhaps not. But yeah, you're right. If you killed somebody in a bar fight, you'd likely be arrested.
In the film, we saw the lawyer from the ACLU characterize the charges against Snowden as being particularly difficult to defend because I believe it was under the Espionage Act that he was charged, and under that act, the lawyer said you can't raise as a defense that the activity that he was revealing was itself illegal, even if the activity stopped and was outlawed by Congress or something like that, then you can't raise that as a defense. Are there other defenses not mentioned in the film that Snowden's lawyers could have used, or the lawyers for a similarly situated individual could have used?
The lawyers in that case were right. There really isn't any defense for this, except, and this is really not a legal defense, jury nullification. You get a jury trial, and you explain to the jury what was going on, and you explain to the jury what he's revealed, and you explain to the jury how government, as a result of what he has revealed, has stopped doing what it was doing, and you ask the jury to acquit.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. I think that's all the time we have. We got another showtime. Thank you so much, Professor Fenner. Thank you all for your discussion.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard discussions which followed screenings of two 2014 documentary films, Alive Inside, directed by Michael Rosato Bennett, and Citizen Four, directed by Laura Poitras. This program, the first half presented in collaboration with the Douglas County Health Center Foundation, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 24, 2015, and Friday evening, December 12, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The members of the Inside Alive panel were Sabra Mackey, Activities, Therapeutic Recreation, and Volunteer Coordinator at the Douglas County Health Center, and Linda Whitfield, Program Director for the Douglas County Health Center. The moderator was Amy Chittenden, President of the Douglas County Health Center Foundation. The special guest in the second half was G. Michael Fenner, James L. Coley Professor of Constitutional Law at the Creighton University School of Law, immediate past president of the Nebraska Bar Association, and author of the article, Edward Snowden, Hero or Traitor. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Patrick Kinney, Caitlin Lavelle, Brooke Masick, Molly Welsh, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.